We are so lucky to have Richard with us. You meet creative people of his caliber only occasionally. And why do I say this? I say this because of the movement which is unstoppable now, and which I think has to be the way that things will go, whereby there is an interface between the brain and technology. You can't get away from that. And I'm not sure that we should even struggle to get away from it. And Richard has been absolutely at the front of this. He was born in Poland, then went to Paris for a small sojourn, and then he went to the only university you should go to in Australia, and I say that because my mother went there, and that's the University of Melbourne, where he's now an emeritus professor. What I like about his work is that he rides the edge. In other words, he's able to combine science with parapsychology, which very few people can do. He says it's much nicer now that he's retired, and I can understand that, because he can be more explicit about what he does. He's been looking into brain rhythms and the communication between different areas of the brain, and also he's got some two-machine projects coming up. I suspect if we had this conference in 50 years' time, there would be little gadgets out there which we'd all use to flicker ourselves and send ourselves into transcendent states. Would we be better? I don't know. But certainly it would be different. So what I would like you all to do is to welcome Richard. And he's going to talk about, if I've got my thing, which I haven't. What are you going to talk about, Richard?
The creative brain, a post-materialist perspective.
Okay, the creative brain, guys, and that's exactly what I was saying. Okay, let's welcome Richard Silverstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Peter, thank you so much for that very, very generous introduction. I must say it gives me enormous pleasure to be here, and I consider it a real privilege to be able to participate in this conference, and thank you so much. A few caveats that I do have to sort of mention at the outset. This is not necessarily my normal tone of voice. I have a slight infection, and just a chest infection, which is in the recovery phase. Unfortunately, the recovery phase seems to be associated with coughing fits now and then, and you may have seen me dashing out from the hall because I didn't want to disturb people in the hall. So if there is some coughing, I really do apologise. I have some lozenges which may or may not work. I'm relying on the placebo effect if they don't. The other thing which is going to make this talk even more interesting, is the fact that I am probably as jet-lagged as I've ever been, because the time zone differences from Melbourne to the UK are significant. My circadian rhythms, internal rhythms, have no idea where I am. So on that note, with those caveats, let's start. Now, I'm going to cover a number of topics in this talk and link them. Some of the links may be convincing to you, some may be slightly less so. There's a significant speculative component to this talk. As Peter mentioned, I have had actually a long-standing interest in parapsychology. Just by way of a little background, my first degree was in physics at, dare I say, Monash University. I had decided that at the end of that, I could go on to continue or do something else. And I thought, parapsychology sounded interesting. It would probably, you know, I thought there could be an opportunity for some decent physics to be introduced. But then I realised that I knew absolutely nothing about the body, or the brain for that matter. So I decided to do a higher degree, master's, then a PhD in neuroscience, then called neurophysiology, at the University of Melbourne. At the end of that, I realized one thing for sure, that if you wanted to commit academic suicide, the fastest way was to exhibit and admit to an interest in parapsychology. Discretion being the better part of valor, I decided to embark on research which was at least of interest to me, but was safe. Generally on the edge of safe, but definitely safe. And it's only now that I've formally retired that I can, so to speak, come out and mention that I have had these long-standing interests. And in fact, what Peter was mentioning earlier is my plans for an experimental study in telepathy using the technology I've developed to see if it can be facilitated. What we will find will be published, whether it's... I have now certain predictions as to what the response will be. If the findings are negative, I'll be patted on the back by some of my ex-colleagues and told, well, you know, I don't quite know why you did it. It was a bit of a waste of time, but just as well someone actually sorted it out and hopefully this will go away. On the other hand, if the results are positive, the response of quite a few of them will be, oh, that's it, Silberstein's lost it. But the results will be what the results will be. Okay then, so I'm going to use the notion of creativity, the creative brain, a very hot topic these days, at so many levels. It has enormous economic implications, but also personal implications, and the notion of differences in creativity, the contributions of creativity, and their relationship to other, quote, disorders, is of enormous interest. And I'm going to use this notion of creativity as a theme running through and touching a number of different areas. Let's just start off with a list of highly creative individuals. One, I don't think there'd be any doubt of any of those. There are many others. Now, what's interesting is that every one of those individuals, if they had been presented to a pediatric psychiatrist, would have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Every single one of them. Now, more recently, there is a growing recognition that there appears to be a link between ADD, particularly attention deficit disorder, and creativity. So let's just start off a little bit. I'm not going to waste too much time. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, the most widely diagnosed pediatric, quote, disorder. It generally combines a combination of inattention, impulse, and impulsivity. So the ADD part, the attention part, and the impulsivity part. Generally, the impulsivity part tends to reduce with age and maturity, but the attention component, on the other hand, tends to persevere. Almost all of the research, until relatively recently, has focused on deficits in neurotransmitters, and the most common one being the role of dopamine, one of the major neurotransmitter systems within the brain. And drugs used to increase the level of dopamine have been the major way that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder has been treated. Because it's not really treated. All that simply happens is the symptoms have been modified. And there is increasing question as to the long-term benefits of stimulant medication, which is the most common used. However, there have been some interesting developments in the neurosciences, and I'm going to cover a number of areas here, so I do apologise. And this flows from work in brain imaging. Okay, let me just explain what I mean by this rather complex diagram. Originally with positron emission tomography, which is one of the earlier brain imaging methodologies, more recently functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, people have looked at changes in the patterns of brain activity while people are given cognitive tasks. And what one generally finds is there is a pattern of regions which light up and which are actually functionally connected when different thinking emotional tasks are engaged in. And the classic ones, if you give people a visual attentional task, there are particular components in the visual cortex which light up and talk to other regions in a consistent fashion. There is a certain that's what's known as there's the so-called dorsal attentional system. This is a region which, among other things, essentially identifies where things are in space, etc. And so these regions light up, and what people saw is essentially what they were looking for, the things lighting up when you were given a task. But there was an embarrassing finding which people didn't mention for quite a while, and that was that when these regions became active when you were given a particular task, there was another part of the brain that became inactive. And what was more embarrassing was that when people were then in the rest state, so generally you'd give a person a task, and then there'd be a rest component, then be another task and rest, etc., the usual sort of thing. And what they found was that this region was at its most active when people were not doing anything in particular. And I thought, well, heavens. And essentially, this is actually a system, a real system. There are certain regions which talk to each other, and people have started focusing on this. So what does this system do? Well, the things that are associated in terms of what the sort of behaviour that is exhibited and the state people are in when this is active is when they're daydreaming, for example, or just not paying attention, or engaging in an internal normal rumination dialogue. What we would refer to as the monkey mind, for example, if you're into meditation, etc. And in fact, there have been studies looking at people engaged in a meditative practice, and in particular, or particular attentional mode, and they need to identify the occurrence of an intrusive thought, or they're distracted, or they're off that. And sure enough, that's when this default mode is more active. The activity is always fluctuating up and down. But in fact, just touching on some of the mindfulness meditation, the mindfulness meditation activates some of these task-related networks. Now, the default mode and these task-related networks have a push-pull, a yin-yang relationship. When one is active, when the task is active, the so-called default mode, this internal mode, tends to be less active, and vice versa. There's sort of a push-pull. Now, what we do know is that in depression, for example, this system is more active, but is also coupled to a region of the prefrontal cortex which seems to be associated particularly with negative affect, negative mood. And so a lot of the self-talking, for example, mediated by this default mode, has a very negative note to it. And that's why we think that the mindfulness meditation, among other things, is able to control that by sort of bringing it more back into balance. Now, what we find is that distractibility and daydreaming are associated with increased default mode activity, and in the case of attention deficit disorder, there is increasing default mode network activity, greater intrusions. And it's suggested that ADHD may be due to an inability to adequately inhibit this default mode network. I think that's possibly an oversimplification, as you'll see. Don't worry about that at this stage. Okay. Now, since then, people have looked more closely at what the default mode network does, and it's not just simply the network that you use when you're twiddling your thumbs, daydreaming, not paying attention to what you should be paying attention to. I must admit, from as a university lecturer, etc., an experience I'm used to, I haven't quite got to the stage where I can identify default mode network activity during my lectures, but I'm pretty close to it. Now, the other thing is that there is now thought that the default mode network is more than just, as I said, the twiddle your thumb network. It seems to be associated with the social brain, the way that we view relationships. And here's an interesting example. If you give a task, a mechanical task, so you've got a siphon there, and the question is, you know, would water flow if there was a hole in the tube? You know, so it's a mechanical question. It's a thought process about things. And what happens is the default mode is suppressed. And you know, other parts become active, and you do the you do your thought. Now, if you present another question on the same side of the movie, which is now a social question, these two people sitting there, question: does he think she is angry? Completely different sort of question. Now the default mode network is more active. So it's a task. You're actually doing something, but the default mode network now is highly active. And the default mode network seems to play a part in mediating a number of processes, including empathy. But too much of a good thing, way overactive default mode network, particularly if it's linked to those negative affect regions, is not a good thing. That's associated with depression. So it's a matter of getting that balance right. But what is interesting is that the default mode network appears to be associated with creativity as well. And I'll come to that in more detail now. So very briefly, some of our work, some of it has been published, some of it is about to be published. But we looked at attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and we were interested in the way that different regions in the brain talk to each other, and we were measuring this using a methodology that was developed in our laboratory, which relies on producing a visual flicker through a set of goggles, and through which you can see a cognitive task. That flicker at 13 cycles per second produces oscillatory electrical activity over all regions of the scalp. It's extremely small, much, much smaller than the EEG. But what we can do is you can use signal processing techniques to basically pull out just that component. And importantly, we can use those signals to give us an indication of how different regions of the brain are talking to each other and how that communication changes on a second-by-second basis. So we're interested in how is the brain organised in children with ADHD compared to controls. And the task we gave them is a pretty boring task. Most of them are, actually. And that is what's called a reference task, where they saw a series of numbers that come up on the screen, and every time the number 5 came up, they had to press a button, and then it'll just start all over again. Sort of Sisyphus type of a task. The active task is what's known as a continuous performance task, where now the letters that come up on the screen are random, and the task is to press the button every time an X comes up on the screen if the letter before it was an A. The moment an A comes up, you've got to be ready. It may be an X, it may not be an X. So what we found, and this is basically an illustration of the number of regions which are talking to each other. Red means there's an increase in communication between those regions. Blue means less. But this is the period during the A. This is the blank between the A and the X, waiting for things, and this is the X. In the case of the control group, there was very, very small changes in communication. However, in the case of the ADHD group, there was this huge increase in activity or in communication across these regions, which we suggest is associated strongly with the activity of the default mode network. Now, so we've seen that. Does this mean anything more than this is a diagnosis for ADHD? And what we then did was to go on and look at a relationship between creativity and brain functional connectivity. And the reason I did that, I should actually acknowledge this, it was a suggestion of an author called Tom Hartman, who has published a number of books on ADHD. And I showed him some of this data, and he said, "Do you think it could be related to creativity?" And the light went on in my head, and we decided to follow up in a study, not with children with ADHD, but people whose creativity score we were able to measure. So there is a scale for creativity, and you can get a measure of people's creativity, and we gave them the same sort of task using this methodology, and we've just gone to the final thing. I'm sorry for the mess, but what this graph here shows are the more creative you are, the more of this connectivity you see during this particular boring task, which is the one where you see these letters A, B, C, D, E, A, B, C, D, E, and you've got to press a button every time the letter E comes up. So what we found was, first of all, sure enough, there was increased connectivity in people who had higher creativity, and it was associated with this default mode network system. And interestingly enough, the effect was strongest after the letter A. Why might that be? Because if you have to press a button on the letter E, that's when you're most sort of focused, tense, etc. That's when the default mode network is least active. But the moment you've pressed and now you're back to A and B again, the default mode network can spring into activity again. So it's also associated with the fact that the default mode network is most active during low arousal states. Now, what this suggests is, as you'll see later, I think we have not so much misdiagnosed, but misconceptualized a lot of ADHD. It's thought and considered a disorder, whereas I suspect it should really be thought of as a mode of thought, a particular way of thinking, particularly associated with high levels of creativity. Now, sure, each mode of thought has its strengths and weaknesses. While there may be high levels of creativity, one may have difficulty finishing tasks, for example. Just a matter of interest, Leonardo da Vinci, probably one of the most creative individuals, he produced, as you know, thousands of sketches for paintings, etc. Throughout his life, roughly, I may not have the figure exact, how many paintings did he actually finish? The answer is, I'm told, around 14. But if you look at the thousands of sketches, etc., this is classic ADD. It's great to start, but it's difficult to sort of follow through. So the point is that some of the most highly creative individuals, which would have been diagnosed ADHD, ADD, etc., and we are diagnosing many individuals now, are in fact probably some of the most valuable individuals in society in terms of creativity. Sure, their educational environment and structure might need to in some way be not adjusted so much, but there are some additional things they might need to do to cope with the current environment, which is not really designed for people with ADD. But I think we're moving away from the simple conceptualization. Now, look, I'm just mindful I'm running out of time. I do apologize for that. All right, change of tone, quick. One of the topics associated with creativity is a very, very an obscure one, inspiration. The process of inspiration, being inspired by certain things. There's a relationship between creativity and inspiration. These are the Greek muses, the nine muses, representing the various disciplines, etc. Now, inspiration, in terms of history and myth, the notion that we're in touch with some other realm, which we channel and these ideas come through. Is there any evidence to suggest that this may be more than just a myth, a fantasy, and no more than that? And to do that, let me just illustrate this with a particular issue, a particular example. In the early 2000s, there was a fascinating book that was published, Why God Won't Go Away, The Neurobiology of the Mystical Experience. And it mainly focused on the experience of certain very, very deep meditators who, on going into these very deep meditative states, had a sense of oneness with the universe, a sense of continuity, that there were no borders, absolute non-duality. There was no self and non-self. There was just, as I said, emerging with the universe. Now, there were other emotions that were associated with that, very powerful ones. But if you look at the brain activity, and this is a very old SPECT methodology, what one found was that there was reduced activity in a particular part of the brain known as the parietal cortex, particularly the right hemisphere. Now, there are two interpretations we can have of that observation. The first and the most and the traditional one is this. The parietal cortex is a region of the brain which, among other things, maps where you are in space and other objects are in space. There are various systems, egocentric systems, in other words, based on myself, where are things in space? There are certain cells in the cortex which will respond only if you can reach and touch an object. So, for example, the microphone, if I look at it, the parietal cells will become active because I can touch it. But if I now move over here and I look, those cells will not be active. So it makes sense if these regions of space, if this part of the brain becomes inactive, your ability to determine where the boundaries are is lost. In pathological cases, say where there's been a stroke, you will have a phenomenon known as hemineglect, where you simply do not pay attention to anything generally on your left if there's a right parietal stroke. So one interpretation is, well, look, that sense of oneness with the universe is simply because the parietal cortex has become very inactive. That's all. But suppose it was more than that. Suppose, in fact, that feeling actually reflected, to a degree, maybe in a distorted fashion, some deeper reality. I mean, real reality. How do we look at that? Well, this is analogous to the sort of same issue in the area of consciousness. A beloved area of neuroscientists especially, as they retire, they all end up writing a book on consciousness. It's the elephant graveyard for neuroscientists. I should say I will probably end up doing the same thing as well. And by far the most common approach is consciousness is basically what the brain does, particular patterns of brain activity, and essentially systems that have certain levels of complexity. The work of Giulio Tononi at University of Wisconsin is probably, I think, one of the leading areas in this, models of, you know, what are the sort of neural constraints and for the production of consciousness. So consciousness essentially is what the brain does, and the limitations of consciousness are essentially determined by the limitations of the brain as a physical system. The other view, far less common, is maybe consciousness is not reducible to just brain activity. Maybe it is some other irreducible component, and maybe the brain acts as a kind of a channel for consciousness, a filtered. These are the two. I would have to sort of say that within the neuroscience community, overwhelmingly, the former is the most common view, by far. Nevertheless, it is an area which warrants research, and I would say the area which has the most direct impact on this is the area of parapsychology. Now, if in fact consciousness is what the brain does, which is essentially a physical system, it's then constrained by the principle of what you might refer to as physical causal closure. In other words, every event within the physical universe is, in a sense, consistent with the preceding events. So each physical state of the brain, environment, etc., is determined entirely by previous physical states of the brain environment. And Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, very, very influential thinker, who, by the way, was a dualist, interestingly. So the physicalist principle of closeness of the physical is of decisive importance and characteristic principle of physicalism or materialism. So that's the most sort of core component. What might be the evidence against physical causal closure? And as I said, it comes from the field of parapsychology. I think there have been, over the decades, a wide array of well-conducted and replicated experiments. I should say I have not actually conducted any studies in parapsychology yet. I will, but at this stage I've been an onlooker. And while I haven't actually conducted any experiments, I can read a scientific paper. I've been on editorial boards and I've reviewed. There have been certainly some shonky papers, but there have been a lot of, more recently, good, well-structured, well-researched, well-thought-through papers. And there are sort of two that I want to, areas that I want to touch on briefly, which are, I think, driving some of the sort of critics of parapsychology, which are, and they refer to themselves as skeptics. I think that's a completely inappropriate term. They are anything but skeptical. They have essentially predetermined worldview, and anything which contradicts this worldview must, by definition, be wrong. End of story. And so then you simply look for what's the validation for my conclusion, which is that it's wrong. One of the most fascinating studies for quite a few years, and Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Research has probably done a lot of this, but not the only one. And this is a so-called pre-sentiment study. Now, I must say, this drives me as a physicist a bit crazy and a lot of people, but nevertheless, here's the data. You can present on a semi-random basis, in other words, you can have a random interval, pictures. The pictures can be highly arousing, and if they are arousing, what will happen is there will be a whole series of physiological changes. These could include galvanic skin response, the easiest and most common one, changes in sweating, essentially, heart rate variations, brain activity changes, and more recently, people have measured it with fMRI. Now, here's the thing. The image that is presented, as I said, randomized, is determined by a random process. And the random processes these days all generally involve quantum random processes. So it's not a random number generator. There are problems with those. These are actual random processes, random numbers, generated by quantum processes. So they are as random as it is absolutely possible to be. And I might add that quantum theory has probably been one of the most quantum mechanics is probably one of the most effective theories in science. It has yet to be shown inaccurate. I mean, and it's coming up with crazy stuff on entanglement, which you know about. Now, here's the point. It's this random number generator that generates the image, which is either a highly arousing image or a boring image. Now, the interesting thing is that if it's a highly arousing image, an emotional image, there will be a small variation in the galvanic skin response prior to the actual choice of the image, So, and this effect, these are statistical error bars, etc. This effect now has been replicated in a number of laboratories. It's an embarrassing one, but it's there. More recently, Daryl Bem at Cornell University created an enormous storm in 2011 when he published in a very highly regarded journal, Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, a series of 9 studies, essentially precognition. And now these studies essentially took some of the classic psychology studies and time-reversed them. So a simple one might be something like this. A person is presented with a screen, and there appears on the screen to be 2 curtains. And you can press left or right button to open the right curtain or the left curtain. Behind one of those curtains is an erotic image. Behind the other one is a non-erotic image of some sort. Now, the point is that the image comes up, the person makes their choice, and they've got a 50-50% chance of being correct. Then the quantum random process determines where the erotic image is to be. And then the curtain goes up, etc. Now, what he found, and this is just one study, that people were getting 53% correct instead of 50. Now, you might say 53, that's not terribly exciting. And it's not. For the numbers he got, that effect is significant at the 0.001 level, which is okay, but nothing really terribly exciting. If you look at individuals who were scored high on extroversion and sensation-seeking, they got 57% correct. That was actually much more significant, would be actually consistent with what you'd expect. And finally, if you look at all 9 experiments overall, the statistical significance was extremely robust, something like 10 to the minus 10. In other words, the chance of getting those sorts of results by chance are more than sort of 1 in 100 billion almost. So very, very significant effects. There was a firestorm of controversy when that was released, etc. I think actually the criticisms were more than adequately answered, in my opinion, from having read both the criticisms and the rebuttals. Currently, there is a paper under review which is in fact a replication based on over 90 separate studies, a meta-analysis of over 90 separate studies, all based on exactly the same paradigm. And here, once again, the effects have come through. These are weak effects, but if you collect a large number, the statistical significance is extremely robust. These are p's of less than 10 to the minus 11. So these are very, very powerful effects. So these parapsychological experiments, I would suggest, are not consistent with physical causal closure. They are, in fact, consistent with that there are other, if you will, there's the phenomena that are accommodated by the laws of physics as we understand them. There are some phenomena, if you drew a Venn diagram, which are not quite there yet. For example, high temperature superconductivity. We haven't quite worked out how that works yet, but it'll be explained. But these sorts of phenomena, being able to be aware of an event even a few seconds before it occurs, in terms of physics, that should not happen. That should not happen. And that sort of phenomena, this is the diagram of all things that are consistent with the laws of physics, it would be situated, you know, way out there. So what I'm suggesting is that our understanding of the laws of physics, and more importantly, is still incomplete. There are other domains as well. And some of these are, in fact, the ones that we look at indirectly through some of these parapsychological experiments. Now, could it therefore, just as in the case of consciousness, that consciousness may be an irreducible component of the universe, which is not simply reducible to physical processes? And I tend to think there is evidence for that. That's my personal view. I may well be wrong, but that's my personal view. And let me just now summarise, because I do apologise for time. So let me just go back. The link between creativity and ADHD is now quite widely recognised, and it's causing a reconceptualisation of ADHD from being a brain disorder to a mode of thought. As I said, with strengths and weaknesses. Creativity and inspiration undoubtedly involve particular modes of brain activity, of course, but parapsychological research leaves open the possibility that creativity and inspiration may also be mediated by the brain, acting as a channel to a deeper transpersonal reality, every bit as real as the physical world around us. So, thank you very much for your indulgence and putting up with me at this rate. I'll finish at this point. Thank you.
What I really like is somebody who works in the same field as me. And I also noted that Richard has yet to put an application into his ethics committee to do some of his parapsychological research. And I hope he gets a better response than I did when I asked to do a Jacobo Grinberg between a dog and a man, you know, emotional linking. And it was looked at them, and they then came back to me and said, it would be a waste of the dog's time. So let's.
It is a good response, I've got to say that.
So if you'd like to discuss this at your tables, then we'll come back with some fascinating and penetrating questions for Richard.
Paul Kinevich. I read about Bim's study when it came out, the Feeling the Future, and my impression was, and I would like your opinion on some of the rebuttals, because one of the rebuttals came from someone who used Bayesian statistics, and which asks a different question as to what's the probability that the hypothesis is correct. And after he had redone the same statistics using Bayesian analysis, he found that the effect went away. And I wondered if you could comment on that study and other studies that came to try to discredit the original result.
Two things. I am familiar with some of the rebuttals. And certainly my reading of some of Bem's rebuttals of the criticisms, evaluated those studies again from a Bayesian statistical approach. And if I remember rightly, Jessica Utes was involved in that. I think she was one of the major developers of the Bayesian methodology. One of the problems with Bayesian statistics as opposed to frequency-based statistics, sure, it has certain advantages, but it also enables you to a certain extent to move goalposts around as well, as to what your a priori probability of the hypothesis being correct is. And in fact, what I think one of the critics had done is to make the probability that the a priori, the previous probability that it was correct, at something like 1 on 10 to the 23, Avogadro's number, basically 1 on Avogadro. In other words, essentially sort of saying, I think this is total crap. It's impossible. I can't give it a probability that it's absolute zero. So I'll come about as close as I can get to zero. And sure enough, if you start with that, and even if you've moved a certain amount, you still get nowhere near enough. I think that's moving the goalposts around. Daryl Bem's most recent study, in fact, involves an extensive Bayesian analysis of all those. The if I remember rightly, the Bayesian factor was some ridiculously high number, 10 to the 9 or thereabouts. A factor of about 100 is regarded as sort of a robust, acceptance. So, as I said, from my reading so far, things seem to be standing up. I think some of the criticisms have been unfounded, and some of them have been, as I said, setting your a priori probability down to some ridiculous value. That's bordering on dishonesty.
Thank you. Oh. Hi, Eve Hicks. My question concerns the research design methodology for the parapsychology research. If, as I believe we are, all interconnected, how it relates to the duality issue, how would you tell which is a push you and how which is a pull you? And my thinking comes from the latest discoveries in quantum physics on the interconnectivity between even individuals and not human or conscious atoms, and the fact that individuals can affect... I'm talking outside my field here, so yeah. I'm sort of struggling a bit, but what I'm saying is that it's possible that the pre-sentient experiences, which I have randomly, sadly, no control over it, and I suspect we all do, you just know something's going to happen and then it happens. How would you control for those effects? And that ignores the cost. So the question is design methodology. I'm interested in your thoughts on it.
Okay, you've covered a number of areas there. I'll try to address some as best I can. Let's start off. Your comment about quantum and quantum entanglement. I must say that the significance of Bell's theorem, which is really where all this started, and quantum entanglement, this is really spooky, weird stuff with the notion that an entangled system comprising, say, two photons, two electrons, two whatever, as long as they're entangled, can, if you make a measurement in one region, instantly, faster than the speed of light, influence the other system. You can't use it to communicate, but that separation and that effect occurs even with, we think, you've got the universe, 13 billion light years separating them. It will still occur. So that really does blow one's mind. People have used that as a metaphor for interconnectedness, and I think it's a very, very powerful metaphor. I would like to see experiments where it becomes more than a metaphor and becomes an actual model when it's applied to more complex systems and even humans. I haven't seen that yet. That doesn't mean it's not going to occur. If you look at some of Dean Radin's work at the Institute of Noetic Science, one of the fascinating studies they've got going for a while is essentially a double slit study, an interference study, where it's really quite weird that if in fact an electron or a photon sees two slits, for example, and you think it will move through one, if you then just keep passing random photons through, what happens is you have an interference pattern build up, as if they know that this is in fact a system which, if the electrons or the photons were waves, they would be interfering with each other. The weird thing is that if you in any way try to determine which of the slits the photon went through, the effect disappears. It becomes a single slit study. Now, what's been found is that if people are asked to look at the equipment, which is sealed in a completely tight, light-proof system, etc., the whole thing is sealed and these photons are being produced, if you try to, if you will, project your mind and observe the double slit, just, as I said, in imagining, but doing it, what happens is the that interference pattern collapses and becomes a single slit pattern, as if the photons were being observed. It's really quite fascinating. But that's where there's a sort of a link between the quantum sort of entanglement and human behavior. Beyond that, I'm not aware of anything that's up there yet.
The experiment, the retroactive, where the you look at a picture behind a screen, erotic, and it's, and then that determines the quantum mechanical selection effect seems to be determined by what you've seen. Is that, as I understand it right?
excuse me. There are two plausible interpretations of that. One is that it's a presentiment; you're aware of it, the event. The other one is it's some sort of telekinesis where you're actually influencing the quantum process. The predominant interpretation at this stage is that it's presentiment. You're being aware of it before the event. But to be frank, both of them are inconsistent with what we would understand from the laws of physics. So there's no recourse to that. Okay.
I just wanted to go back to what was mentioned before of the rebuttals to Daryl Bem studies. And you were saying, well, if you start from an a priori hypothesis that there's nothing there, then you're sort of moving the goalposts. And anyways, at Bayesian statistics, you're sort of moving the goalposts. And I just wanted to make two points about that. The first is the p-value of less than 0.05 is a random goalpost that was agreed to at some point. And so that is not necessarily a better goalpost. It's just another goalpost. And then the fact that you start from an a priori hypothesis that nothing is there is how you start with most scientific studies. You assume, at least for the first ones, that there's nothing there, and then you want to have evidence that there is. And once you have enough studies suggesting that there is, you might start change your a priori hypothesis. And then the other point was, it's also the issue of replication. So besides the fact that you might analyze a particular study with different statistical methods, the point is, in general, one study, even if it's nine studies, doesn't mean much because what should matter is the bulk of studies. And then that's a big problem within psychology that's been discussed a lot, and not just psychology, but actually all science, because in medicine it's a similar problem and so on, which is the fact that there's very little publication of non-replication studies. So when people don't replicate studies, that's very hard to publish. And so we have a file drawer effect where we don't know what the negative results were. So those were just some thoughts.
Okay, thank you for your thoughts. Just going through, I don't know if I'll have time to comment on all of them, but let's just, on the final one, the file drawer effect, people have looked at the file drawer effect and have looked at how many studies would need to have been conducted to basically dilute the ones that have been published, dilute them to insignificance. So I think people have taken that issue seriously and have looked at it. The other one is, I would take issue with you on the notion that your a priori probability should be zero if you've just started something completely new. First of all, in the case of parapsychology, there's at least 50, 60 years of published work in different areas, which some of it may be controversial, but others have been replicated where there are findings and you'd have to start from some sort of a priori positive probability. Even if you're doing an experiment for the very, 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 very first time, all experiments essentially come from a hypothesis, and that hypothesis is generally based on a series of ad hoc or, sort of case studies, observations. So there's a sort of an underlying intrinsic notion. Otherwise, if you really, really thought the probability was zero, you wouldn't be doing that study. If you that really, 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 really was zero, and certainly,
you don't need to assume it, but the statistics.
No, yeah, but that's I think that I would think that's part of the problem of that particular mode of interpretation of Bayesian methodology. Your point about 0.05, sure, of course, 0.05 is, in fact, it's an extraordinarily weak criterion. Most of the studies yield p-values much, much lower than that, etc. And obviously, if one were sort of relying on studies where p-values of 0.05 were what you were getting, I would be really worried about that. So I think that's all I've got to say about your points. Thank you.
Actually, this is an important point. Are you happy with the reply, or do you want to take it further?
With the p-values, regardless of whether it's p05 or p01 or whatever it is, that it's just a different way of thinking of the problem.
Sure. Yeah.
And Bayesian, you get strength of evidence, and then you can more easily also combine different studies.
Yeah.
But you know.
The most recent study of BEMS method. And that meta-analysis, there's a great weakness in meta-analysis in that you're combining different design type studies, and there's a real problem there. But in this particular case, Darrell has in fact released the specific methodologies, and there was a very clear constraint that they needed to be precisely followed. So I think it strengthens the meta-analysis basis of the report.
Okay, thank you. Right, yes, you have the mic.
Hello? Hello. Yes. Gosh, I've got too much to say on this, so I won't take up time. I've actually personally involved in educating psychiatry, I have to say. I don't have delusions of grandeur, but there's so much to say on the whole of this so-called learning difficulties, you know, dyspraxia, dyslexia, all these, the whole spectrum, which is completely ignored in psychiatry. They have nothing to say. It's not in the DSM. And so people go there with these conditions which present with extreme anxiety, very stressful. They're basically social deviant. Because people really struggle in social context, they're therefore stigmatized and sent to and seen as mental conditions. And it's really such a waste of huge potential. So I'm really pleased with your positive light, and you need to disseminate it very widely. And it really fits in with the positive psychology movement, I feel, flourishing. Because I feel my personal... I've got so much to say. I've actually worked in mental health, and I've seen a misdiagnosis. Bipolar disorder is a common assumption for somebody who's hyperactive, ADD. Mania used to be called manic depression, and they've changed the name for PC reasons, and it's about time schizophrenia was changed, because it's terribly stigmatizing, and all it is a collection of symptoms. It doesn't actually, it's not a condition. And schizophrenia, in my experience, has been misdiagnosed. Asperger's has been misdiagnosed as schizophrenia in psychiatry I've come across, because there's no understanding in psychiatry of these learning difficulties and so on. They're sent to, they're hoped picked up in school. They're dumped in educational psychology. They're not always picked up. And so these poor people who are just struggling in life, but highly creative and intelligent often, end up in prisons or mental health because it's so distressing. So thanks for that. It's very important, I feel, in a good way forward to see it in a positive light. And I feel that even Asperger's, Google is the house of Asperger's. Everybody at Google is, they're very high functioning people. My uncle was at NASA, a very big scientist. And there's a lot of positives.
Do you have a question, or is it just a comment?
I really would like you to push that forward. It's very important, I feel, and very helpful for a lot of people. And I think it's 10%, not 5% of the population on that spectrum.
Okay.
I might just comment. I think there is a reconceptualization taking place about the significance of ADHD in the direction that I think you would welcome. We'll get there, but it is happening. It is happening.
Okay, I think we probably have time for three more questions. Bernard, you, and you, and that would probably be it, which would be sad. You're second. Okay, well, Bernard.
Richard, first of all, I'm so pleased you mentioned that, you know, the parapsychological aspects and the presentiment effect, because I realize I can get you into trouble, but it's safe to talk about it here in the SMN, and I agree with you that if there is any evidence for an irreducible mind, it's primarily coming from the best evidence comes from parapsychology. But I would like to ask you to clarify the link between the first part of your talk and the second part of the talk, because obviously what you said about ADHD was very compelling. But then I wasn't completely convinced how you went from that to the link with the parapsychology and the other links of reality. I mean, to put it another way, I mean, the title of our meeting, Free Spirits or Determined Machines, I could understand the implication of the second part of your talk, that is, you know, there is a room for free spirit because you've got to go into this other level of reality. I wasn't quite clear from the discussion of the ADHD why that couldn't be discussed at the determined machine level.
Look, it can. You know, the link, it's there, but it's tenuous. I admit that. Look, I was trying to link a number of themes. I wanted to use creativity as an overarching notion. So the ADHD was really introduced because I think that because of the link between creativity and ADHD. Now, from creativity then to inspiration, is inspiration, you know, the notion I'm inspired, things that from without me are influencing my ideas. Then there was a sort of a gentle shuffle to, is this analogous to the question of consciousness? It's a relatively weak link, I agree, and maybe in fact it's really two talks, but I've tried to link them as best I can.
You wouldn't say creativity itself is parapsychological.
No, but maybe. No. Although I would not deny that there may be a transpersonal parapsychological aspect to some acts of creation, but generally I'm not arguing that you know, the creative process is in any way linked to parapsychological phenomena. No, if I gave that impression, that's not the case. As I said, there may be an element to it, but no more than that.
Okay, thank you. Yes.
John Mansack, back to Bayesian analysis, the critical analysis by Wagenmacher of Daryl Bem's experiments. Dick Biermann is a Dutch psychologist working at the same university as Wagenmacher. He looked at his analysis, walked over to Wagenmacher and said, "Hey, you are using an effect size of 0.5, while Daryl Bem has achieved 0.23. Why didn't you use 0.23? "Well, it's by default value in Bayesian analysis 0.5, he said. "Well, redo it, please." When he redid that, the results were significant. So just this small change shows how sensitive the subjective assumptions in Bayesian analysis can be.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Yes. Last question.
What these type of experiments show, I believe, is that there is still room in our theory of the physical world for new ideas, for creative thinking. Non-locality is one example, relatively recent, of creative thinking. And to anyone who has emerging ideas of such thoughts of the way we look at the physical world, the a priori probability that you'd have to prove would be much nearer normal values. I'm sorry, I forgot what I was going to say to start with, is that most of what we regard as conventional, in most of what we regard as conventional physics, there were substantial observations of phenomena and experimental data before there were people who could put together the a theory of how we should formulate our view of the physical world. And I'm delighted that serious experimental data is being accumulated, because this nearly always has to come first. That's all. And there's room for creative minds.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I might just comment briefly. Quantum theory has been an amazingly effective theory, an accurate theory. But does that mean that's the end of history? essentially we've basically got the perfect theory, and it's just a matter of sort of working out all the implications. I don't believe that. I believe that there will be new theories which incorporate all the observations within quantum and relativity, etc., in exactly the same way that general relativity incorporated Newtonian gravity, for example, etc. So I think eventually those those theories will incorporate all the phenomena that we identify in some of the parapsychological domains as well. But it will be a completely different theory to the sort of theory that we currently have. That's my personal view.
Okay, well, that's a really good point to end on. I think we've had a very stimulating discussion. Of course, as you know, we're both more or less in the same field. In fact, we met in Tokyo about 6 years ago. And I think that electrical activity of the brain gives a totally different picture from the fMRI picture of the brain, because one is very slow and the other you can get down to. We were getting down to a third of a millisecond, 300 microseconds, by the time I left Japan. So you're looking at things which are really very different. So what I would like you to do is to thank Richard very much indeed for his talk.